Greetings, everyone. Good to see you here. All right, we're going to get started. This is Dr. Will Tuttle, and this is May 2nd, Thursday, the first Thursday of May, 2nd of May, and this is 2024. We're going to go ahead and have our first Thursday meditation. Can't wait. Here we are. And I don't know where everybody is. Everybody's playing hooky today, I guess. They're all meditating. But anyway, we'll go ahead and get started. So it's great to be back here and with Yuma, our piano, and doing our meditation at the piano here. You want to say hi? Or? Here's Madeline. She's right here. She wants to. Great. So we'll go ahead and get started. And I know people sometimes come in late, but we like to start right on time. We have a Swiss household here, and we start on time. And, I mean, we're actually about 1 or 2 minutes late, but we're more or less on time. So, I think we'll go ahead and just jump into the meditation and then open it up for comments and questions. I'm kind of excited a little bit because I just finished reading this book, The Light of Asia. Have you read this? The Light of Asia by Sir Edwin Arnold. It's a 150-page poem that he wrote in 1868 or something. And it's about the life of the Buddha. And it's really inspiring. And it has one little passage I want to read because it very much parallels what we're seeing with the new movie Christspiracy. It's a really beautiful parallel to that. So we'll go ahead and get started. So I'm sitting at the piano, and I'd just like to invite everyone now to get comfortable and relaxed, and we'll begin our meditation time. Here we go. Enter into this present moment. Becoming aware of our breathing and allowing ourselves to relax into each breath. With every exhalation, letting go of any thoughts of the past or of the future. Allowing ourselves to breathe together, opening up the soles of our feet to the earth. The infinite spirit manifesting as the earth, this beautiful and abundant home, temporary home, supporting all living beings here, bursting forth now here in springtime joy and splendor, in the beautiful and merry month of May. We're just breathing with the earth, breathing with the infinite life, bursting forth in flowers and trees and baby birds and fishes and the great celebration of life. And now with every exhalation, we just let go ever more deeply. Into this moment, letting go of everything else. And feeling our oneness, our unity with the infinite life that sings and lives and thrives in every cell of our being. Radiating vitality and wisdom, creativity and joy, kindness and compassion into every dimension of our being. Abiding in the infinite light, radiant light of our true nature. Breathing and giving thanks for this inner wisdom, the inner intelligence that regulates every system, that inspires our creativity, that brings every dimension of our life into abundance, into understanding. And we feel now our heart, smiling, grateful and happy and joyful for all of the blessings of this life. For this precious opportunity of this moment, of this day and this time, of all of our relations, of all of our talents and abilities, all of the gifts that we have been given and continue to be given. This very breath, a gift. That we freely receive and return. A gift of all of the trees, the oxygen and vitality. One life. Flowing. The ocean is the life of all the waves, each of us a wave on the infinite ocean of life, continuing our journey toward the shore, looking out and smiling. Sending our love now to all living beings.
to all the human beings, the whole human family, knowing that each and every human being is a precious gift. Contributing always to the unfoldment of the highest celebration of life. We give thanks for all of the animals and all the dimensions and environments and ecosystems, from the great whales, all the birds, and all the way down to the little creatures, so beautiful in their magnificent perfection. The little butterflies, caterpillars, all living beings, we send forth our love and appreciation. May they always be happy and free from suffering. May we continue to connect with like-minded people to build a more enlightened society, to co-create a world that reflects the truth of the interconnectedness of all life and the infinite light of kindness, joy, and freedom that shines in every cell of our being. Awakening of humanity. Breathing together, giving thanks for the shared aspiration for spiritual illumination, for making a contribution to the healing of our world, for understanding our part in rescuing our society from delusion and deception. So now we, again, feeling our connection with the earth and with the infinite sky, representing the eternal life that exists far beyond this world. Our true home. That what we are is infinite and eternal consciousness, never born and never dying, abiding always in the space of love. Our true home, radiant health and freedom and joy and peace, is our true home. So we now connect with the four aspects of our true home and send us forth into the infinite web of relations, breathing and radiating love. Kindness and benevolence with every exhalation, with every inhalation, engendering in our heart this feeling of loving kindness. It's ever present. May all beings be happy and at peace, abiding in our true home of love and radiating love with every breath. With every inhalation, we connect with the true home of compassion. And with every exhalation, radiating compassion to all living beings. The yearning that all beings be free from suffering, and the urge to do our best to help relieve the suffering of others. Abiding in compassion, breathing and radiating compassion. With every inhalation, now we connect with and engender our true nature of joy, the joy that spontaneously emerges from our heart as we realize the great blessing of being. With every exhalation, we allow this feeling of joy to radiate out to all living beings, bringing joy into the lives of others, recognizing the joy that is always present. Abiding in our true home of joy, breathing and radiating joy to all. And now finally we give thanks for this inner home that is ever present of peace and harmony. We dwell always in peace. And so with every exhalation, we allow this peace to flow from our heart in ever-expanding spheres of bright white light, filling the whole world with the light of peace, seeing the whole earth bathe in the light of peace, the truth of being. So we give thanks for our unity with the infinite source of life, the source of love, compassion, joy and peace, knowing that every dimension of our life is enriched, is fulfilled, and is enabled by the ever-present reality. The spiritual truth of the infinite life that flows continually into our heart and mind from the source of all life, unifying us with all expressions of life and with our true nature. May all beings be happy and at peace. May all beings be free. And may each one of us, as we go forth, connect every day more deeply with the inner wisdom, joy, and awareness that are our true nature, for the benefit not just of ourselves and our loved ones, but for the benefit of all. We give thanks knowing this is so, and so it is. Participating in our meditation time. Wonderful to see you. And as we know, this is our time, this hour that we have on Thursday, the first Thursday of the month, from 5 o'clock to 6 o'clock California time, is an opportunity for us to join together in just affirming the underlying truth that we are part of something far greater that is really beautiful, an awakening of humanity toward compassion and kindness and the liberation of humanity from the delusion of animal agriculture and the delusion of war and slavery and the domination of the sacred feminine dimension of life, which is really the foundation of the health of our society and of ourselves as individuals. And so I'd like to first of all just say that if you have any urgent thing you'd like me to address, then go ahead and just either go down to, if you're on your computer, you can go to the reactions and raise your hand. You can unmute also, pressing star 6 allows you to unmute. If you are on a phone or just mute yourself on the computer, this is not just my time, this is our time, so you're definitely welcome to ask a question or share something, if a grief or a sorrow or a joy or anything like that. Like I said, for those of you who got here a little later, you didn't hear me say it, but over the last, maybe 10 days or so, I've been reading this book, The Light of Asia, by Edwin Arnold, the British Sir Edwin Arnold. I guess he was knighted. He has a 154-page poem about the life of Shakyamuni Buddha in India. And this came out way back, you know, like I say, in the 1800s. So it was when the West really was kind of unfamiliar with the teachings of Asia, but it was coming in, and it was very exciting to many of the mystical people of the time. And I think the transcendentalists in Concord, you know, I was born and raised in Concord, Massachusetts. And for me, you know, being raised in Concord, Massachusetts, and learning to swim in Walden Pond and discovering Thoreau and Emerson and Alcott and these people, and I realized later, you know, I was really touched by their teachings, the transcendentalist teachings,
And they were bringing in for the first time into North America the teachings of Buddhism, Taoism, Hinduism, the idea of rebirth, the idea of karma, the idea of God as female as well as male, the idea of God as a law or a principle that you can live in harmony with. You know, these very, very provocative ideas that don't really conflict too much, I don't think, with the essential Christian teachings or the Western teachings. But they add another dimension. So this was all happening. I remember reading that Thoreau, apparently back in the 1840s, had the largest library in North America of these books. He somehow got a hold of them when they were first getting translated. And so this book, The Light of Asia, is one of those old first glimmerings of what these teachings were all about. And I had heard about this book for decades, but I never actually read it. So I just finished reading it actually this morning. I always read for a few minutes in the morning. And one of the things, you know, those of you who have been watching who have watched Christspiracy, you know that one of the fundamental teachings in that movie, it's really trying to help people understand the idea that Jesus really cared about animals. You know, that he was actually upset at the temple, that not because they were stealing or gypping people or cheating people, but because they were slaughtering animals. That's one of the main revelations an attempted revelation. I think, and not everybody's going to believe it, but I think you can definitely make a strong case that that's probably true, as far as we can tell, that was part of the teachings of Jesus and the Ebionites, the people that he was part of. It looks like they were the a branch of the Essenes Christians, and they were well known. You've maybe heard me say this, for the four vows that they took, which was to never swear, to never own slaves, to never eat meat, and there was one more, I think, was to never go to war or to fight. And so they had communities, and the teachings of Jesus, of course, exemplify these quite a bit. But of course, as you know, as I discuss in the World Peace Diet, the culture that we live in now, and really we lived in back then, was based on herding animals. It was a herding culture that was based on herding animals. So for Jesus to question herding animals itself was a difficult thing, very challenging. And the movie makes the case, and I think also people like Keith Akers and other biblical scholars also agree, that this was it. This was the reason he was actually killed, was because... there's a great book called Jesus Lived in India. I highly recommend it, by Holger Kirsten. If you ever have a chance to, I read this book, a German scholar who makes a really good case. Actually, he wrote that book and another one on the Shroud of Turin, that Jesus did not die on the cross. I mean, that kind of, to me, it just illuminates everything. You know, he was a strong, young yogi, really healthy guy. He was only in his 30s. And he suffered like heck. I mean, they stabbed him and they did all this stuff. But he was still alive. And when he went into the cave and came out 3 days later, it was because, you know, he came back and he was never actually killed. He was just, and the Roman centurions were actually, the main one was a student of his, and he didn't want to kill him. I mean, there's a whole research on this. It's a big research, and there's huge evidence that he then went to India. And there's all kinds of, if you go to India, there's this Saint Isa and this whole thing about Jesus who lived, he lived there after that. He went on. He never died, actually. but that's not in the movie. But the whole idea was that he was also an animal rights activist. I mean, he wanted to protect the animals. And that was what the whole thing at the temple was about. But so anyways, I was reading this book, The Light of Asia, and you know the story of the Buddha, but these are two archetypal stories. Jesus' story is very archetypal, of sacrificing himself for the world, you know, this idea. And the Buddha story is also this powerful story, and I wish I can't obviously sum it up, but I want to just read one passage, because I think I was amazed when I read this. It's so interesting because what happens, the Buddha is born as a prince in this kingdom in North India, what is Nepal. And his father, as soon as he's born, all these miracles kind of happen, these interesting things. He's born of a virgin, actually. His mother sees a vision of a white elephant, and then he's just born. And these people say he's either going to be a great king or he's going to be a great spiritual teacher. And, of course, his father wants him to be a great king. So he's raised in total luxury so that he never sees any suffering. So he doesn't have any spiritual impulse. It's just like living in a heaven realm where everything is fine. So they don't allow him to see any bad things because otherwise his heart would open to compassion. But of course he does. He sees a bird kill something and he sees various things. And then at one point he really wants to go out and he sees an old person, he sees a sick person, he sees a dead person. And so all these plant seeds in his life. So even though he's married to a beautiful princess she's pregnant actually. He just knows it's his time to leave home, to leave that beautiful, inheritance that he has. He'll be the great king of this whole area. It's a very thriving kingdom. And he goes off and he leaves and he shaves, I don't know if he shaves his head, but he gives away all his good clothes, his horse, everything, and he just puts on rags. And he spends 6 years basically living in these mountains with other people who are dedicated to spirituality too back then. There was a lot of people doing that. I mean, it's so interesting. 2,500 years ago, there are people who are just leaving the world and living out there, meditating and doing a lot of really, the book describes the extremes they were going to, like they would hold their arm up and never take it down, so the arm just eventually withers. And they were doing all these mortifications of the flesh and to get to a higher state, but he didn't think that was the right thing. So then he's still not enlightened yet. It's before he sits under the Bodhi tree. He sees a shepherd bringing some sheep into the local city where the king is, and so he just decides to walk along with these sheep and goats. And so they walk into the city. And he's before he becomes the Buddha, he's still a seeker. And this is what happens. I mean, just listen, I'm just going to read it. It's not that long, but I think it's so interesting. So, here we go. So, then someone told the king, "There cometh here a holy hermit, bringing down the flock which thou didst bid to crown the sacrifice." The king stood in his hall of offering. This is King Bimbarasa, who later becomes a disciple of the Buddha. And so, on either hand, the white-robed Brahmins ranged, muttered their mantras, feeding still the fire which roared upon the midmost altar. There, from scented woods, flickered bright tongues of flame, hissing and curling as they licked the gifts of ghee and spices and the soma juice, the joy of Indra. Round about the pile, a slow, thick, scarlet streamlet smoked and ran, sucked by the sand, but ever rolling down, the blood of bleating victims. One such lay, a spotted goat, long-horned, its head bound back with munja grass, at its stretched throat the knife pressed by a priest who murmured, This dread gods of many yajnas cometh as the crown from Bimbisara. Take ye joy to see the spurted blood and pleasure in the scent of rich flesh, roasting amid the fragrant flames. Let the king's sins be laid upon this goat, and let the fire consume them, burning it, for now I strike. But Buddha softly said, "Let him not strike, great king," and therewith loosed the victim's bonds, none staying him. So great his presence was. Then, craving leave, he spake of life, which all can take, but none can give. Life, which all creatures love and strive to keep, wonderful, dear, and pleasant unto each, even to the meanest, yea, a boon to all. Where pity is, for pity makes the world soft to the weak and noble for the strong. Unto the dumb lips of his flock he lent sad pleading words, showing how man, who prays for mercy to the gods, is merciless, being as God to those, albeit all life is linked and kin, and what we slay have given meek tribute of the milk and wool, and set fast trust upon the hands which murder them. Also he spake of what the holy books do surely teach, how that at death some sink to bird and beast, and these rise up to man in wanderings of the spark, which grows purged flame. So were the sacrifice new sin, if so the fated passage of a soul be stayed. Nor spake he, shall one wash his spirit clean by blood, nor gladden gods, being good, with blood, nor bribe them, being evil, nay, nor lay upon the brow of innocent bound beasts one hair's weight of that answer all must give for all things done amiss or wrongfully, alone each for himself, reckoning with that the fixed arithmetic of the universe, which meeteth good for good and ill for ill, measure for measure, unto deeds, words, thoughts, watchful, aware, implacable, unmoved, making all future fruits of all the past. Thus spake he, breathing words, so piteous, with such high lordliness of ruth and right. The priests drew back their garments over their hands, crimsoned with slaughter, and the king came near, standing with clasped palms, reverencing Buddha, while our Lord went on, teaching how fair this earth were, if all living things be linked in friendliness, in common use of foods, bloodless and pure, the golden grain, bright fruits, sweet herbs, which grow for all, the waters, wan, sufficient drinks and meats, which when these heard, the might of gentleness so conquered them. The priests themselves scattered their altar flames and flung away the steel of sacrifice. And through the land next day passed a decree proclaimed by criers, and in this wise engraved on rock and column, quote, thus the king's will is, there hath been slaughter for the sacrifice and slaying for the meat, but henceforth none shall spill the blood of life nor taste of flesh, seeing that knowledge grows and life is won and mercy cometh to the merciful. So ran, end quote. So ran the edict, and from those days forth, sweet peace has spread between all living kind, man and the beasts which serve him and the birds on all those banks of the Ganges where our Lord taught with his saintly pity and soft speech. Isn't that amazing? I mean, I really, when I read that, I thought, wow, that is amazing. And that's 2,500 years ago. You know, that's 500 years before the whole thing with Jesus in India. And it parallels a lot of what we see, you know, what we hear anyway of Jesus, although there's this difference, right? I mean, Jesus is portrayed as being really outraged at the violence, and Buddha is portrayed as just with his presence, just preaching this idea of kindness and caring. And they had a foundation, it sounds like. He talked about the holy books, talking about reincarnation, that if we die, we could be born as a bird or an animal. Birds and animals could be born as humans. So we shouldn't be, we should not cause these beings to die. He also talks, of course, about the fact that every being loves to live. We shouldn't steal that from them. And all these different things that that are based on the underlying spiritual dimension of compassion and kindness, and also of karma, and that you can never have your sins be washed away by committing violence, right? You can't. This whole idea of a sacrifice is just absurd. So, and it's interesting because because he got this from the ancient texts, and the ancient texts are right in the sense that. At the time, up until the Buddha's time, there was really a lot of sacrifice going on in India. There was a sacrificial kind of a religion, and Buddha's teaching and Buddhism as it spread, it really stopped that. That's why India is known to be a vegetarian country. It's really because of this what happened. What we just read about. I mean, that kind of set in motion this massive push toward not killing. It was the Buddhist teachings that thrived in India for 1,000 years that pushed and gave force to vegetarianism in India. And I would say there's a good evidence that, for example, because by the year beginning of the Common Era. Buddhist monks had already traveled all the way to England, spreading this teaching of the Buddhist teaching of compassion for all life and spiritual awakening, including vegetarianism, or probably what we would call veganism. And so they had definitely come through the Eastern Mediterranean region. And I think it's highly likely that Pythagoras was influenced. And also the Essenes, Jesus was born into the Essenes, and his brother James is known, James the Just, that he never ate meat and he wouldn't even wear wool. So this was what we would call a vegan culture. It could have very easily been followers of the Buddhist teaching that had, hundreds of years earlier. But the underlying idea is that this Buddha who gave up everything, gave up this beautiful wife and a child and kingdom and everything else, and decided to attain enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. That on that quest, before he attained enlightenment, he had this experience of liberating, and that's kind of started it. And it's pretty well known that after Buddha. Passed away, his movement just grew and grew and grew. And about 200 years later, the great king Ashoka, had a huge kingdom, he converted to Buddhism, and he became a vegetarian. And he put up these monuments all over India, prohibiting any eating of meat. I mean, that's really what really made India the vegetarian country, the most vegetarian country in the world. It was really Ashoka, a disciple of the Buddha a couple hundred years later, but it was that basic wisdom of that he's so, I think Edwin Arnold does a great job just bringing it out, the truth of the interconnectedness of life and the fact that we can all eat these other foods. We can eat grains and vegetables and fruits and so forth. And the neat thing, I think, is that the way it's portrayed here, they didn't want to kill him. In fact, they did the opposite. I didn't read it, but then the next day, Bimbisara, the king, invites him in to his palace and says, I don't have a son. Would you like to be the next king here? You can have the whole kingdom. he says, no, I got other things I got to do. I could have had a kingdom already. I gave it up. but he tells him that he has other things to do. And then it's quite a story to read then how he goes. And he gets to the point where he's meditating so one-pointedly and so so absolutely not giving up. He's underneath the Bodhi tree, or actually before he goes to the Bodhi tree, but in that general area, that he finally just collapses, and he's basically looks like he's dead. But a shepherd comes by and gives him a little bit of food and some rice, and then a woman comes by and helps him a little bit more with some food, and then he vows he will never get up until he attains enlightenment. And then in the third and fourth watches of the night, everything is revealed, and he has this tremendous awakening, and he sees all his former lifetimes, over 500 former lifetimes. He sees every single one. And like it says, it's really neat how he talks about it. Like, he's at the top of a mountain. If you're at the top of a mountain, you can see the whole path that led all the way through all the jungles and then up over the ridges. And then he could just see that. And this whole long, hundreds and hundreds of lifetimes that had led him finally to this peak where he understood what you can never put into words. And experience the complete joy and freedom of being that is a true nature of all of us. And then he thought, this teaching is so profound, I can never teach it. People have to go do what I did. You can't teach this to somebody. They have to do what I did. They have to quiet their mind and wake up. But the devas and these beings pleaded with him that there are some human beings you can help. And so he said, all right, I'll do my best to teach this. And then rolling the wheel of the Dharma for the next 45 years. He traveled around and gave talks. But the underlying teaching, I think, is really in alignment with what Jesus taught. I mean, what all the great spiritual teachers taught. It's the golden rule. It's karma, right? No, don't do that. Whatever we do, it's going to come back. And he talks really a lot about karma, about the idea that it was a little bit here, that there's a law, and whatever you do that's kind and loving, for sure, it will absolutely determine your future. It may be very quickly, maybe in four or five lifetimes away, but it definitely will. And everything we do that's harmful definitely will do that. But most people think when they think of karma, they have this kind of negative thing like, ooh, I don't want to think about that, Don't tell me, I don't want to hear about it. This is kind of this feeling of like, oh man, all my thoughts, especially your actions, all these actions I've done, it's going to come back, But the way he talks about it is, like pure joy. It's like, this is the greatest thing. We, each one of us, can actually make our everyday better and better and better and better and better without end. I mean, we are the cause ourselves. Our actions and our thoughts and our words are the cause. I mean, what is more joyful and liberating and empowering than that? That's it. I mean, this is like the greatest good news you could ever imagine. We create through our actions and thoughts our experience. We just don't see the connections because there's multiple lifetimes and we forget and all this. But when we understand that, we just say, all right, whatever happens in the outer world, it's not so much what happens, it's how I respond to it. What kind of response? Because our response either expands and raises our awareness, or it reduces and creates more suffering for ourselves and others. And we're not ever, ever, ever separate from others. Whatever we do to others, we're doing to ourselves, absolutely. And so that's the thing. So that's why animal agriculture is such an absolutely devastating practice, because we're acting in a completely diabolical way in regards to these animals. We just absolutely take pleasure in causing them pain, right? I mean, we enjoy. I mean, we're not sadistic in that sense, but the idea is that we don't care about the suffering that we inflict on them. And in a sense, it's ironic because we're born into a culture that does that, and so we just follow orders and go along. But that's not an excuse, because here we are, we're vegans, we figured it out. What's your problem? Like, why haven't you figured it out? Well, everybody has their reasons, but it's just creating more and more slavery and suffering and disease. And they don't understand why. That's why it's so important for us who understand this to try to help people to understand, to try to be skillful in our way of bringing the message. Because really, in many ways, it's up to us to embody what veganism is as loving kindness and compassion, like the Buddha did. That they say this over and over again. The Buddha, it's not what he says. It's his presence. That's what makes the difference. It's always the presence, his aura, his, you know. And I think that's an important point. You know, we're always trying to think, well, how can I put it? What words can I use? And that's not it. It's really how deeply and authentically are we actually embodying compassion and kindness. And to me, the whole vegan movement doesn't even understand this. The whole vegan movement is about, let's come up with more vegan products and let's figure out how we can make things that will change people's minds. We need to really bring spirituality into this. Spirituality, which is authentic spirituality, is understanding and living and embodying these teachings. And when we do that, then we'll make progress. If we don't do that, we can't fake. We just end up fighting and arguing, creating all these organizations that make money, and who knows what they do with the money. So it really comes back to us. I think each one of us as individuals, and getting inspired by the teachings and finding our own unique way of bringing it to the world. You know, I think we each have our own unique way of doing it, and that's it. So. Anyway, thanks everyone for, already only 8 minutes left, for bearing with me while I went through that. But I think, that so parallels in a very, very telling way the main story in Christspiracy and that whole thing. And it also shows, how far the Buddhists have come. I mean, those particular Buddhists had come, how far they had fallen when you had the Tibetan Buddhist guy saying, well, oh yeah, we know that if you're eating a hot dog, you could be eating your grandmother, you know, after she passed away. It's possible, you know, we know that, you know, but then later he goes, well, it tasted pretty good. I mean, they made these Buddhists look like utter fools and hypocrites. I mean, and they should be. I mean, good for them. They are. They're acting that way. But I guess what bothered me was that they didn't interview some of the Buddhists, like from the Zen monastery where I lived in Korea, or the ones that I visit when we go to Taiwan, who are really vegan, organic vegan, and living it, because there's millions of Buddhists that are vegan and are living it. So it would have been nice if they would have, I think, shown that more clearly, because there are some, especially in China, in Eastern Asia. But there's a lot of Buddhists in the West, and also in Thailand and other places that justify eating animal food. So there's confusion in the traditions, like there is in pretty much all the religions. We talk about that quite a bit, unity also. So anyway, does anyone, let me see. That's interesting. Judy Carmen says, Thich Nhat Hanh guesses that if the Buddha had been living where Jesus lived, he would have been killed as well. Yeah, that's so true. Yeah, it showed really the fact that they honored his presence and his words, how open they were to these higher teachings. The people, even the regular, you know, the people that were making their money by slaughtering animals, the Brahmins, they realized, well, you know, he's right, and they let it go. They didn't try to kill him. They honored him. So that says a lot about the awareness of the people at that time, I think. And that's one of the things that I really think is important to understand, because we live in a society where we think that people in the past lived brutal, nasty, short lives, right? But thank God we have technology and we have long, happy lives now. You know, that's what we tell ourselves. I mean, look at these people. They spend their whole life sitting in front of a computer in a cubicle, thinking they're having this great life and they can buy a steak. I don't think we realize, I mean, it's over and over again, if you read these ancient texts, many of these people are filled with joy. They're happy. They're connected with nature and with their, you know, they have their problems, but in here, it's really interesting. You read about people that are really happy And they didn't have the, I mean, think of all the drugs we have and the pharmaceuticals and the slavery of technology. I mean, technology is really such a curse. I think we have to really get clear about that. And we're using it like right now, but I'm telling you, when you see the incredible beauty and profundity of these teachings from 2,500 years ago, nobody's talking like that now. I mean, all we do is blabber really shallow things compared to this. I mean, this if you read this, you know, this is very extremely profound. And so I think we need to get back to the ancient wisdom traditions and honor them and quiet our minds and reconnect and turn off a lot of this technology and not buy into this idea that technology is going to save us. What's going to save us is spirituality. If you read my new book, I talk about that. Everybody. And if you can, please write a review. I would love to have some more reviews on Amazon. And thank you, those of you who have done that. That's great. But I think now we're at pretty much at our time. Is there any other? Yeah, okay. I see. Oh, look at this. Kenny Rossler, Seeing Spiritual Community. Yeah, so you know about that. Rabbi Gabriel Cousins, exactly. Yeah, he's totally talking about that. And thank you, Julie, for congratulating us for winning the Homo Ahimsa Award. It's all more about how we could possibly keep coming back here for more lives. I don't understand how it can be endless.
Yeah, right. How can it be endless? Well, the teaching, I don't have a lot of time here, but basically the teaching is that as long as we are deluded, we keep coming back. It's a circle. It's a cycle. You're born. There's the 12 links, and this is a whole discussion. But the 12 links, birth leads to then seeing and sensing and thinking, and then delusion, wanting things, fighting, whatever. That leads, then we die, and then we have unfulfilled desires, so we come back again in another incarnation to fulfill it. We just keep whatever you want. You want more money? Okay, have a lifetime with a lot of money. You want whatever you want, you're going to get it. But as long as we're in delusion, we keep desiring and craving or not wanting and fighting, and so that just keeps the whole thing going. So it continues as long as our delusion continues, and we're here to learn and grow and so forth and contribute and help others, because it's like all around us, we're all in the same boat, basically. And but it does end. But like in the Four Noble Truths, there's suffering and there's a cause of suffering, but then there's the end of suffering. You know, it does end, but only if you walk the path, right? If you actually do the cultivation of clarifying the mind and becoming in one pointed in attention and being kind and loving to others in every thought, word, and deed. I mean, it's a real work that one is then called to do. It's not some like a weekend workshop. It's really a total transformation. And then that's referred to as liberation. And it's hard to talk about it after that. I mean, then it's like, you know, you get into this. You realize there's not this separate self, this body that I think I am is not what I am, and then what am I? Well, you're the infinite, eternal life that makes this possible, but how do you put that into words? And it's when the mind stops, finally, that there's an awareness of this. And so it's nothing you can will and to make it happen. We just are called to do our version of the spiritual path. And if we don't get it, that's what Buddha keeps saying, you know, it's like, if you can get to the point where you're a twice returner, that means you'll come back for only two more lifetimes. Then if you can get to the point where you're a once returner, only come back for one more, and then on that last one, you know, that's the idea. But, you know, you just try to basically purify the mind and the actions. And I think, part of that is really savoring the beauty of our life and of the people around us and appreciating that and contributing to the beauty in the world. And part of that is being kind, of course, to animals and nature and appreciating that. So This is all interconnected, I think. But thank you. That's a great question. We can maybe go into that more maybe next month. Yeah, why not? All right. So let's we've gone a little bit over here. So let's thanks everyone for joining us. We have our third Thursday, as you know, in a couple of weeks, and let's say our closing meditation. We love you and appreciate you. So and stay in touch. And you saw that I sent out the notification that we have a video of the launch gathering. Thank you, Lisa, for coordinating that also. So let's unmute your microphones and we can say this together. Here we go.
Compassion
circles
the earth
for all beings
everywhere.
Compassion circles the earth for all beings everywhere.
Yay!
Love you guys. Thanks so much for joining us and. Spread the word about the new book, Food for Freedom, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you.
Bye-bye, everybody. Have a good week.
Love to everyone.
Thanks. Bye. Thanks so much. Love you.
Bye-bye, Will.
Bye-bye. Thank you. Bye,
everybody.
Shalom.
Congratulations.
Thank you.